cot, the rain pouring down outside, was oddly like the control room of the submarine in We Dive at Dawn. I imagine the rolling thunder of the storm to be the sound of depth charges exploding immediately above our heads, and suddenly I was not quite so fearful for Father. We two, at least, were allies. I would pretend that as long as we kept still and I remained silent, nothing on earth could harm us. Father went on as if there had been no interruption.
"We became rather strangers, Boney and I," he said. "Although we continued as members of Mr. Twining's magic circle, each of us pursued his own particular interests. I developed a passion for the great stage tricks, sawing a lady in half, vanishing a cage of singing canaries, that sort of thing. Of course, most of these effects were beyond my schoolboy budget, but as time went on, it seemed enough simply to read about them and learn how each one was executed. Boney, however, progressed to tricks which required an ever greater degree of manual dexterity, simple effects which could be done under the spectator's nose with a minimal amount of gadgetry. He could make a nickel-plated alarm clock disappear from one hand and appear in the other before your very eyes. He never would show me how it was done. It was about that time that Mr. Twining had the idea of organizing a philatelic society, another of his great enthusiasms. He felt that in learning to collect, catalogue, and mount postage stamps from round the world, we would learn a great deal about history, geography, and neatness, to say nothing of the fact that regular discussions would promote confidence among the more shy members of the club. And since he was himself a devoted collector, he saw no reason why every one of his boys should be any less enthusiastic. His own collection was the eighth wonder of the world, or so it seemed to me. He specialized in British stamps, with particular attention to color variations in the printing inks. He had the uncanny ability of being able to deduce the day, sometimes the very hour, a given specimen was printed. By comparing the ever-changing microscopic cracks and variations produced by wear and stress upon the engraved printing plates, he was able to deduce an astonishing amount of detail. The leaves of his albums were masterpieces, the colours, and the way in which they ranged across the page, each one a dab from the palette of a Turner. They began, of course, with the black issues of 1840, but soon the black warms to brown, the brown to red, the red to orange, the orange to bright carmine, on to indigo and Venetian red, a bright blossoming of colour, as if to paint the bursting into bloom of the empire itself. There's glory for you.
I had never seen Father so alive. He was suddenly a schoolboy again, his face transformed and shining like a polished apple. But those words about glory, hadn't I heard them before? Weren't they the ones spoken to Alice by Humpty Dumpty? I sat quietly, trying to work out the connections his mind must be making.
"For all that," he went on, "Mr. Twining was not in possession of the most valuable philatelic collection at Grayminster. That honour belonged to Dr. Kissing, whose collection, although not extensive, was choice, perhaps even priceless. Dr. Kissing was not, as one might expect of the head of one of our great public schools, a man born either to wealth or to privilege. He was orphaned at birth and brought up by his grandfather, a Bell foundry worker in London's East End, which, in those days, was better known for its crushing living conditions than for its charity, and for its crime rather than its educational opportunities. When he was 48, the grandfather lost his right arm in a ghastly accident involving molten metal. Now no longer able to work at his trade, there was nothing for it but take to the streets as a beggar, a predicament in which he remained sunk for nearly 3 years. 5 years earlier, in 1840, the London firm of Messrs. Perkins, Bacon and Petch had been appointed by the Lords of the Treasury as the sole printers of British postage stamps. Business prospered. In the first 12 years alone of their appointment, some 2 billion stamps were printed, most of which eventually found their way into the dustbins of the world. Even Charles Dickens referred to their prodigious output of Queen's heads. Happily, it was in the Fleet Street printing plant of this very firm that Dr. Kissing's grandfather found employment at last, as a sweeper. He taught himself to push a broom with one hand better than most men did with two, and because he was a firm believer in deference, punctuality and reliability, he soon found himself one of the firm's most valued employees. Indeed, Dr. Kissing himself once told me that the senior partner, old Joshua Butters Bacon himself, always called his grandfather Ringer, out of respect to his former trade. When Dr. Kissing was still a child, his grandfather often brought home stamps that had been rejected and discarded because of irregularities in printing. These pretty bits of paper, as he called them, were often his only playthings. He would spend hours arranging and rearranging the colourful scraps by shade, by variation too subtle for the human eye unaided. His greatest gift, he said, was a magnifying glass, which his grandfather bargained away from a street seller after pawning his own mother's wedding ring for a shilling. Each day, on his way to and from the board school, the boy called upon as many shops and offices as he was able, offering to sweep their pavements clear of rubbish in exchange for the stamped envelopes from their waste paper baskets. In time, those pretty bits of paper became the nucleus of a collection which was to be the envy of royalty, and even when he had risen to become headmaster of Grayminster, he still possessed the little magnifying glass his grandfather had given him. "Simple pleasures are best," he used to tell us. The young Kissing built upon the tenacity with which life had favoured him as a boy, and went on from scholarship to scholarship, until there came the day when old Ringer was on hand in tears to see his grandson graduate with a double first at Oxford. Now, there is a belief among those who should know better that the rarest of postage stamps are those freaks and mutilations that are inevitably produced as by-products of the printing process, but this is simply not so. No matter what sums such monstrosities might fetch if they are leaked upon the market, to the true collector they are never more than salvage. No, the real scarcities are those stamps which have been put into official circulation, legitimately or otherwise, but in very limited numbers. Sometimes a few thousand stamps may be released before a problem is noticed, sometimes a few hundred, as is the case when a single sheet manages to effect its escape from the treasury. But in the entire history of the British Post Office, there has been one occasion, and one occasion only, when a single sheet of stamps was so dramatically different from its millions of fellows. This is how it came about. In June of 1840, a crazy potboy named Edward Oxford had fired two pistols at nearly point-blank range at Queen Victoria and Prince Albert as they rode in an open carriage. Mercifully, both shots missed their target, and the Queen, who was then 4 months pregnant with her first child, was unharmed. The attempted assassination was thought by some to be a Chartist plot, while others believed it to be a conspiracy of Orange men who wished to set the Duke of Cumberland upon the throne of England. There was more truth in the latter than the government believed, or perhaps than they were prepared to admit. Although Oxford would pay for his crime by spending the next 27 years of his life confined to Bedlam, where he seemed more sane than most of the inhabitants and many of the doctors, his handlers would remain at large, invisible in the metropolis. They had other hares to run. In the autumn of 1840, an apprentice pressman named Jacob Tingle was employed at the firm of Perkins, Bacon and Petch. Because he was, above all else, a creature of ambition, young Jacob was soon progressing in his trade by leaps and bounds. What his employers did not yet know was that Jacob Tingle was the pawn in a deadly serious game, a game to which only his shadowy masters were privy. "If there was anything that surprised me about this tale, it was the way in which Father brought it to life. I could almost reach out and touch the gentlemen in their high-starched collars and stovepipe hats, the ladies in their bustled skirts and bonnets. And as the characters in his tale came to life, so did Father." Jacob Tingle's mission was a most secret one. He was, by whatever means were at hand, to print one sheet, and one sheet only, of penny black stamps, using a bright orange ink which had been provided for his mission. The vial had been handed to him, along with a retaining fee, in an alehouse adjoining St. Paul's Churchyard, by a man with a broad-brimmed hat, who sat in the tavern shadows and spoke in a stony whisper. When he had secretly printed this bastard sheet, he was to conceal it in a ream of ordinary penny blacks, which were awaiting dispatch to the post offices of England. With this accomplished, Jacob's work was done. Fate would see to the rest. Sooner or later, somewhere in England, a sheet of orange stamps would surface, and their message would be plain enough to those with eyes to see. "We are in your midst," they would declare. "We move amongst you freely and unseen." The unsuspecting post office would have no opportunity to recall the inflammatory stamps, and once they came to light, word of their existence would spread like wildfire. Not even Her Majesty's government could keep it quiet. The result would be terror at the highest levels. "You see," Father went on, "although his message came too late, a secret agent had infiltrated the ranks of the conspirators and sent back word that discovery of the orange stamps was to serve as a signal to conspirators everywhere to begin a new wave of personal attacks upon the royal family. It seemed the perfect scheme. Had it failed, the perpetrators would simply have bided their time and tried again another day. But there was no need to try again. The thing went off like clockwork. The day after he met the stranger in St. Paul's churchyard, there was a spectacular and suspicious conflagration in an alley directly behind Perkins, Bacon and Petch. As the printers and clerical staff dashed outside for a better view of the fire, Jacob coolly pulled the vial of orange ink from his pocket, inked the plate with a spare roller he had hidden behind a row of chemical bottles on a shelf, applied a damped sheet of watermark paper, and printed the sheet. It was almost too easy. Before the other workers returned to their posts, Jacob had already tucked the orange sheet among its black sisters, cleaned the plate, hidden the soiled rags, and was setting up for the next run of ordinary stamps when old Joshua Butters Bacon himself strolled by and congratulated the young man on his coolness in the face of danger. He would go far in his chosen trade, the old man told him. And then fate, as fate so often does, threw a wrench into the works. What the plotters could not foresee was that the man in the broad-brimmed hat would, that very night, be struck down in the rain in Fleet Street by a runaway cart-horse, and that with his dying breath he would revert to the faith into which he had been born and confess the plot, Jacob Tingle and all, to a rain-caped bobby whom he mistook for a cassocked Catholic priest. But by that time, Jacob had done his dirty work, and the sheet of orange stamps was already flying, via the night mail, to some unknown corner of England. "I hope you're not finding this too boring, Harriet."
"Harriet? Had Father called me Harriet?"
It is not unknown for fathers with a brace of daughters to reel off their names in order of birth when summoning the youngest, and I had long ago become accustomed to being called Ophelia, Daphne, Flavia, dammit.
But Harriet? Never. Was this a slip of the tongue, or did Father actually believe he was telling his tale to Harriet?
I wanted to shake the stuffing out of him. I wanted to hug him. I wanted to die. I realized that the sound of my voice might break the spell, and I turned my head slowly from side to side, as if it were in danger of falling off. Outside, the wind was tearing at the vines that fringed the window as the wild rain came pelting down.
"The hue and cry was raised," Father went on at last, and I stopped holding my breath. "Telegraphs were sent to every postmaster in the realm. To whatever corner of England the orange stamps might make their way, they were to be placed at once under lock and key, and the Treasury notified, post-haste, of their whereabouts. Because larger shipments of the penny blacks had been sent to the cities, it was thought that they would most likely make their appearance in London or Manchester, perhaps Sheffield or Bristol. As it turned out, in fact, it was none of these. Tucked away in one of the farthest pockets of Cornwall is the village of St. Mary in the Marsh. It is a place where nothing had ever happened, and nothing was ever expected to. The postmaster there was one Melville Brown, an elderly gentleman who was already some years past the usual retirement age and was trying, with little luck, to put away a bit of his small salary to tide him over to the churchyard, as he told anyone who would listen. As it happened, since St. Mary in the Marsh was off the beaten track in more ways than one, Postmaster Brown did not receive the telegraph directive from the Treasury, and so it was with complete surprise that, some days later, after he had unwrapped a small shipment of penny blacks and was counting them to see that the tally was correct, he found the missing stamps literally at his fingertips. Of course he spotted the orange stamps at once. Someone had made a dreadful mistake. There had not been, as there normally should have been, an official instructions to postmaster's pamphlet announcing a new colour for the penny stamp. No, this was something of vast import,
even though he could not say what it was. For a moment, but only a moment, mind you, he thought that this oddly coloured sheet of stamps might be worth more than its face value. Less than half a year after their introduction, some people, most likely people up in London, he believed, who had nothing better to do with their time, had already begun collecting self-adhesive postage stamps and putting them in little books. A stamp printed off register or with inverted check numbers might even fetch a quid or two. As for a whole sheet of them, why... But Melvin Brown was one of those human beings who seemed to be as scarce as archangels. He was an honest man. Accordingly, he at once sent off a telegraph to the Treasury, and within the hour a ministerial courier was dispatched from Paddington to retrieve the stamps and convey them back to London. The government intended that the rogue sheet be destroyed at once, with all the official solemnity of a pontifical requiem mass. Joshua Butters Bacon suggested rather that the stamps be placed in the printing house archive, or perhaps in the British Museum, where they could be studied by future generations. Queen Victoria, however, who was, as the Americans say, more than a bit of a pack rat, had her own ideas. She asked to be given a single stamp as a memento of the day she was spared an assassin's bullet. The remainder were to be destroyed by the highest-ranking officer of the firm that had printed them. And who could deny the Queen? By now, with British troops about to invade Beirut, the Prime Minister, Viscount Melbourne, whose name had been once linked romantically with Her Majesty's, had other things on his mind. And there the matter was allowed to rest. So it was that the world's only sheet of orange penny stamps was burned in a cruet on the desk of the Managing Director of Perkins, Bacon and Petch. But before he lit the match, Joshua Butters Bacon had, with surgical precision, snipped off two specimens. This was some years before perforations were introduced, you see. The stamp marked AA from one corner for Queen Victoria and, in great secrecy, another marked TL from the opposite corner for himself. These were the stamps which would one day be known to collectors as the Ulster Avengers. Although for many years before they were given that name, their very existence was a state secret. Years later, when Bacon's desk was moved after his death, an envelope which had somehow become lodged behind it fell to the floor. As you may have guessed, the sweeper who found it was Dr. Kissing's grandfather, Ringer. With old Bacon dead, he thought, what harm could there be in his taking home as a plaything for his three-year-old grandson the single bright orange postage stamp which lay nestled within it? I felt a flush rising to my cheek and prayed desperately that Father was too distracted to notice. How, without making the situation even worse than it was, could I tell him that both of the Ulster Avengers, one marked AA and the other TL, were, at that very moment, stuffed carelessly into the bottom of my pocket? Chapter 17. Part of me was positively twitching to pull out the blasted stamps and press them into his hand, but Inspector Hewitt had put me on my honour. I could not possibly put into Father's hands anything which might have been stolen, anything which might further incriminate him. Fortunately, Father was oblivious. Even another sudden flash of lightning, followed by a sharp crack and a long roll of thunder, did not pull him back to the present.
"The Ulster Avenger, marked TL, of course," he went on, "became the cornerstone of Dr. Kissing's collection. It was a well-known fact that only two such stamps were in existence. The other one, the specimen marked AA, having passed upon the death of Queen Victoria to her son, Edward VII, and upon his death to his son, George V, in whose collection it remained until recently, was stolen in broad daylight from a stamp exhibition. It has not been recovered."
"Ha!" I thought. "What about the TL?" I said aloud.
"TL, as we have seen, was tucked safely away in the safe of the headmaster's study at Grayminster. Dr. Kissing brought it out from time to time, in part to gloat, he once told us, and in part to remember my humble beginnings in case I should ever show signs of rising above myself. The Ulster Avenger was seldom shown to others, though, perhaps only to a few of the most serious philatelists. It was said that the King himself had once offered to buy the stamp, an offer that was politely but firmly declined. When that failed, the King begged, through his private secretary, special permission to view this marmalade phenomenon, as he called it, a request which was speedily granted and which ended with a secret after-dark visit to Greyminster by his late Royal Highness. One wonders, of course, whether he brought A.A. with him, so that the two great stamps might be once more, if only for a few hours, reunited. That, perhaps, will forever remain one of the great mysteries of philately. I touched my pocket lightly, and my fingertips tingled at the slight rustle of paper. Our old housemaster, Mr. Twining, clearly recalled the occasion and remembered, most poignantly, how the lights in the headmaster's study burned long into that winter night. Which brings me back, alas, to Horace Bonepenny. I could tell by the changed tone of his voice that Father had once more retreated into his personal past. A chill of excitement ran up my spine. I was about to get at the truth. Bony had, by this time, become more than an accomplished conjurer. He was now a forward, pushy young man with a brazen manner who generally got his own way by the simple expedient of shoving harder than the other fellow. Besides the allowance he received from his father's solicitors, he was earning a good bit extra by performing in and around Greyminster, first at children's parties and then later, as his confidence grew, at smoking concerts and political dinners. By then he had taken on Bob Stanley as his sole confederate, and one heard tales of some of their more extravagant performances. But outside of the classroom, I seldom saw him in those days. Having risen above the abilities of the magic circle, he dropped out of it and was heard to make disparaging remarks about those amateur noodles who kept up their membership. With its dwindling attendance, Mr. Twining finally announced that he was giving up the halls of illusion, as he called the magic circle, to concentrate more fully upon the Stamp Society. I remember the night. It was in early autumn, the first meeting of the year, that Bony suddenly showed up all teeth and laughter and false good fellowship. I had not seen him since the end of the last term, and he now seemed to me somehow alien and too large for the room. "Ah, Bonepenny," Mr. Twining said. "What an unexpected delight. What brings you back to these humble chambers?" "My feet," Bony shouted, and most of us laughed. And then suddenly he dropped the pose. In an instant he was all schoolboy again, deferential and filled with humility. "I say, sir," he said, "I've been thinking all during the halls about what a jolly treat it would be if you could persuade the head to show us that freakish stamp of his." Mr. Twining's brow darkened. "That freakish stamp, as you put it, Bonepenny, is one of the crown jewels of British philately, and I should certainly never suggest that it be trotted out for viewing by such a saucy scallywag as yourself." "But, sir, think of the future, when we lads are grown, have families of our own." At that we grinned at one another and traced patterns in the carpet with our toes. "It would be like that scene in Henry V, sir," Bony went on. "Those families back in England home abed will count themselves a curse they were not at Greyminster to have a squint at the great Ulster Avenger. Oh, please, sir, please." "I shall give you an alpha plus for boldness, young Bonepenny, and a goose egg for your travesty of Shakespeare. Still." We could see that Mr. Twining was softening. One corner of his moustache lifted ever so slightly. "Oh, please, sir," we all chimed in. "Well," Mr. Twining said. And so it was arranged. Mr. Twining spoke to Dr. Kissing, and that worthy, flattered that his boys would take an interest in such an arcane object, readily assented. The viewing was set for the following Sunday evening after chapel, and would be conducted in the headmaster's private apartments. Invitation was by membership in the Stamp Society only, and Mrs. Kissing would cap the evening with cocoa and biscuits. The room was filled with smoke. Bob Stanley, who had come with Bony, was openly smoking a gasper, and nobody seemed to mind. Although the sixth form boys had privileges, this was the first time I had seen one of them light up in front of the head. I was the last to arrive, and Mr. Twining had already filled the ashtray with the stubs of the Wills's gold flake cigarettes which, outside of the classroom, he smoked incessantly. Dr. Kissing was, as are all of the truly great headmasters, no mean showman himself. He chatted away about this and that, the weather, the cricket scores, the old boys' fund, the shocking condition of the tiles on Anson House, keeping us in suspense, you know. Only when he had us all twitching like crickets did he say,
"Dear me, I had quite forgotten. You've come to have a look at my famous snippet."
By now we were boiling over like a room full of tea kettles. Dr. Kissing went to his wall safe and twirled his fingertips in an elaborate dance on the dial of the combination lock. With a couple of clicks, the thing swung open. He reached in and brought out a cigarette tin. An ordinary gold flake cigarette tin.
That fetched a bit of a laugh, I can tell you. I couldn't help wondering if he'd had the cheek to pull out the same old container in front of the king.
There was a bit of a hubbub, and then a hush fell over the room as he opened the lid. There inside, nestled on a bed of absorbent blotting paper, was a tiny envelope, too small, too insignificant, one would say, to hold a treasure of such great magnitude. With a flourish, Dr. Kissing produced a pair of stamp tweezers from his waistcoat pocket and, removing the stamp as carefully as a sapper extracting a fuse from an unexploded bomb, laid it on the paper. We crowded round, pushing and shoving for a better view.
"Careful, boys," said Dr. Kissing. "Remember your manners, gentlemen always."
And there it was, that storied stamp looking just as one always knew it would look, and yet so much more spellbinding. We could hardly believe we were in the same room as the Ulster Avenger. Boney was directly behind me, leaning over my shoulder. I could feel his hot breath on my cheek, and thought I caught a whiff of pork pie and claret. Had he been drinking, I wondered. And then something happened which I will not forget until my dying day, and perhaps not even then. Boney darted in, snatched up the stamp, and held it high in the air between his thumb and forefinger like a priest elevating the host. "Watch this, sir," he shouted. "It's a trick." We were all of us too numb to move. Before anyone could bat an eye, Boney had pulled a wooden match from his pocket, flicked it alight with his thumbnail, and held it to the corner of the Ulster Avenger. The stamp began blackening, then curled. A little wave of flame passed across its surface, and a moment later there was nothing left of it but a smudge of black ash in Boney's palm. Boney lifted up his hands and in an awful voice chanted, "Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. If the king can't have you, the devil must." It was appalling. There was a shocked silence. Dr. Kissing stood there with his mouth open, and Mr. Twining, who had brought us there, looked as if he had been shot in the heart. "It's a trick, sir," Boney shouted, with that charnel house grin of his. "Now help me get it back, all of you, if we all join hands and pray together." He grabbed my hand with his right, and with his left he seized Bob Stanley's. "Form a circle," he ordered. "Join hands and form a prayer circle." "Stop it," Dr. Kissing commanded. "Stop this insolence at once. Return the stamp to its spot, Bonepenny." "But, sir," Boney said, and I swear I saw his teeth glint in the light of the flames from the fireplace. "If we don't pull together, the magic can't work. That's how magic is, you see."
"Put the stamp back in the box," Dr. Kissing said, slowly and deliberately, his face like one of those ghastly things one finds in a trench after a battle.
"All right, then. I'll have to go it alone," Boney said. "But it's only fair to warn you it's much more difficult this way." Never had I seen him so confident. Never had I seen him so full of himself. He rolled up his sleeve and held those long, white, pointed fingers upright in the air, as high as he could reach. "Come back, come back, O Orange Queen, come back and tell us where you've been." At this, he snapped his fingers and suddenly there was a stamp where no stamp had been a moment earlier. An orange stamp. Dr. Kissing's grim face relaxed a little. He almost smiled. Mr. Twining's fingers dug deeply into my shoulder blade, and I realized for the first time that he had been hanging on to me for dear life. Boney reeled the stamp in for a closer look until it was almost touching the tip of his nose. At the same time, he whipped an indecently large magnifying glass from his hip pocket and examined the newly materialized stamp with pursed lips. Then suddenly, his voice was the voice of Chang Fu, the ancient Mandarin. And I swear that even though he wore no makeup, I could clearly see the yellow skin, the long fingernails, the red dragon kimono.
"Uh-oh, honorable ancestor Sen Long stamp," he said, holding it out to us for our inspection. It was an ordinary internal revenue issue from America, a common Civil War vintage stamp, which most of us had aplenty in our albums. He let it flutter to the floor, then gave a shrug and rolled his eyes heavenward. Come back, O Orange Queen," he began again. But Dr. Kissing had seized him by the shoulders and was shaking him like a tin of paint. "The stamp," he demanded, holding out his hand, "at once." Boney turned out his trouser pockets one after another. "I can't seem to find it, sir," he said. "Something seems to have gone wrong." He looked up each of his sleeves, ran a long finger round the inside of his collar, and a sudden transformation came over his face. In an instant, he was a frightened schoolboy who looked as if he'd like nothing better than to make a bolt for it. "It's worked before, sir," he stammered, "lots and lots of times." His face was growing red, and I thought he was about to cry. "Search him," Dr. Kissing snapped, and several of the boys, under the direction of Mr. Twining, took Boney into the lavatory where they turned him upside down and searched him from his red hair to his brown shoes. "It's as the boy says," Mr. Twining said when they returned at last. "The stamp seems to have vanished."
"Vanished?" Dr. Kissing said. "Vanished? How can the bloody thing have vanished? Are you quite sure?"
"Quite sure," Mr. Twining said.
A search was made of the entire room. The carpet was lifted, tables removed, ornaments turned upside down, but all to no avail. At last, Dr. Kissing crossed the room to the corner where Boney was sitting with his head sunk deeply in his hands.
"Explain yourself, Bone Penny," he demanded.
I can't, sir. It must have burned up. It was supposed to be switched, you see, but I must have... I can't..."
And he burst into tears.
"Go to bed, boy," Dr. Kissing shouted. "Leave this house and go to bed."
It was the first time any of us had ever heard him raise his voice above the level of pleasant conversation, and it shook us to the core. I glanced over at Bob Stanley and noticed that he was rocking back and forth on his toes, staring at the floor as unconcernedly as if he were waiting for a tram.
Boney stood up and walked slowly across the room towards me. His eyes were rimmed with red as he reached out and took my hand. He gave it a flaccid shake, but it was a gesture I found myself unable to return.
"I'm sorry, Jacko," he said, as if I, and not Bob Stanley, were his confederate. I could not look him in the eye. I turned my head away until I knew that he was no longer near me.
When Boney had slunk from the room, looking back over his shoulder, his face bloodless, Mr. Twining tried to apologize to the headmaster, but that seemed only to make matters worse.
"Perhaps I should ring up his parents, sir," he said.
"Parents? No, Mr. Twining, I think it is not the parents who should be brought in."
Mr. Twining stood in the middle of the room wringing his hands. God knows what thoughts were racing through the poor man's mind. I can't even remember my own. The next morning was Monday. I was crossing the quad, tacking into the stiff breeze with Simpkins, who was prattling on about the Ulster Avenger. The word had spread like wildfire, and everywhere one looked, knots of boys stood with their heads together, hands waving excitedly as they swapped the latest and almost entirely false rumours. When we were about 50 yards from Anson House, someone shouted, "Look! Up there, on the tower! It's Mr. Twining!" I looked up to see the poor soul on the roof of the bell tower. He was clinging to the parapet like a tattered bat, his gown snapping in the wind. A beam of sunlight broke through between the flying clouds like a theatrical spotlight, illuminating him from behind. His whole body seemed to be aglow, and the hair sticking out from beneath his cap resembled a disk of beaten copper in the rising sun, like the halo of a saint in an illuminated manuscript.
"Careful, sir," Simpkin shouted. "The tiles are in shocking shape."
Mr. Twining looked down at his feet, as if awakening from a dream, as if bemused to find himself suddenly transported 80 feet into the air. He glanced down at the tiles and for a moment was perfectly still. And then he drew himself up to his full stature, holding on only with his fingertips. He raised his right arm in the Roman salute, his gown fluttering about him like the toga of some ancient Caesar on the ramparts. "Valet," he shouted. "Farewell." For a moment, I thought he had stepped back from the parapet. Perhaps he had changed his mind. Perhaps the sun behind him dazzled my eyes. But then he was in the air, tumbling. One of the boys later told a newspaper reporter that he looked like an angel falling from heaven, but he did not. He plummeted straight down to the ground like a stone in a sock. There is no more pleasant way of describing it. Father paused for a long while, as if words failed him. I held my breath. "The sound his body made when it hit the cobbles," he said at last, "has haunted my dreams from that day to this. I've seen and heard things in the war, but nothing like this. Nothing like this at all. He was a dear man and we murdered him. Horace Bonepenny and I murdered him as surely as if we had flung him from the tower with our own hands." "No," I said, reaching out and touching Father's hand. "It was nothing to do with you."
"Ah, but it was, Flavia."
"No," I repeated, although I was a little taken aback by my own boldness. "Was I actually talking to Father like this?" "It was nothing to do with you. Horace Bonepenny destroyed the Ulster Avenger." Father smiled a sad smile.
"No, he didn't, my dear. You see, when I got back to my study that Sunday night and removed my jacket, I found an oddly sticky spot on my shirt cuff. I knew instantly what it was. While joining hands to form his distracting prayer circle, Boney had pushed his forefinger inside the sleeve of my jacket and stuck the Ulster Avenger to my cuff. But why me? Why not Bob Stanley?" "For a very good reason. If they had searched us all, the stamp would have been found in my sleeve and Boney would have cried innocence. No wonder they couldn't find it when they turned him inside out. Of course, he retrieved the stamp as he shook my hand before leaving. Boney was a master of prestidigitation, remember, and because I had once been his accomplice, it stood to reason that I should have been so again. Who would ever have believed otherwise?"
"No," I said.
"Yes."
Father smiled.
"And now there's little more to tell. Although nothing was ever proved against him, Boney did not return to Greyminster after that term. Someone told me he had gone abroad to escape some later unpleasantness, and I can't say I was surprised. Nor was I surprised to hear, years later, that Bob Stanley, after being ejected from medical school, had ended up in America, where he had set up a philatelic shop, one of those mail-order companies that place advertisements in the comic papers and sell packets of stamps on approval to adolescent boys. The whole business, though, seems to have been little more than a front for his more sinister dealings with wealthy collectors. As for Boney, I didn't see him again for 30 years. And then, just last month, I went up to London to attend an international exhibition of stamps put on by the Royal Philatelic Society. You might remember the occasion. One of the highlights of the show was the public display of a few choice items from our present Majesty the King's collection, including the rare Ulster Avenger, AA, the twin of Dr. Kissing's stamp. I gave it little more than a glance. The memories it brought back were not pleasant ones. There were other exhibits I wished to see, and consequently the King's Ulster Avenger occupied no more than a few seconds of my time. Just before the exhibit was to close for the day, I was at the far side of the exhibition hall, examining a mint sheet to which I thought I might treat myself, when I happened to glance across and catch a glimpse of shocking red hair, hair that could belong to only one person. It was Boney, of course. He was holding forth for the benefit of a small crowd of collectors who had gathered in front of the King's stamp. Even as I looked on, the debate became more heated, and it seemed that something Boney had said was agitating one of the curators, who shook his head vehemently as their voices rose. I didn't think that Boney had seen me, nor did I want him to. It was fortuitous that an old army friend, Jumbo Higginson, happened along at that very moment and dragged me off for a late dinner and a drink. Good old Jumbo. It's not the first instance where he's turned up just in the nick of time.
Something came over Father's eyes, and I saw that he had vanished down one of those personal rabbit holes which so often engulfed him. I sometimes wondered if I would ever learn to live with his sudden silences. But then, like a jammed clockwork toy that jerks abruptly back to life when it's flicked with a finger, he went on with his story as if there had been no interruption.
When I opened the newspaper on the train home that night and read that the King's Ulster Avenger had been switched for a counterfeit, this apparently done in full view of the general public, several irreproachable philatelists, and a pair of security guards, I knew not only who had carried off the theft, but also, at least in general terms, how the thing had been accomplished. Then, last Friday, when the jacksnipe turned up dead on our doorstep, I knew at once that Boney had been there. Jacksnipe was my nickname at Grayminster, Jacko for short. The letters at the corner of the penny black spelled out his name. It's very complicated.
B1H, I said. Bonapenny, Horace. At Grayminster he was called Boney and you were Jacko for short. Yes, I figured that out quite some time ago. Father looked at me as if I were an asp which he was torn between pressing to his breast and flinging out the window. He rubbed his upper lip with his forefinger several times as if to form an airtight seal, but then went on.
Even knowing that he was somewhere nearby did not prepare me for the dreadful shock of seeing that white, cadaverous face which appeared suddenly from out of the darkness at the window of my study. It was after midnight. I should have refused to speak with him, of course, but he made certain threats. He demanded I buy both of the Ulster Avengers from him, the one he had stolen recently and the one he had made to vanish years ago from Dr. Kissing's collection. He had it in his head, you see, that I was a wealthy man. It's the investment opportunity of a lifetime, he told me. When I replied that I had no money, he threatened to tell the authorities that I had planned the theft of the first Ulster Avenger and commissioned the second, and Bob Stanley would back up his claim. After all, it was I who was the stamp collector, not he. And hadn't I been present when both of the stamps were stolen? The devil even hinted that he may have already, may have, mind, planted the Ulster Avengers somewhere in my collections. After our quarrel, I was too upset to go to bed. When Boney had gone, I paced up and down in my study for hours, agonizing, going over and over the situation in my mind. I had always felt responsible in part for Mr. Twining's death. It's a terrible thing to admit, but it's true. It was my silence that led directly to that dear old man's suicide. If only I'd had the intestinal fortitude as a schoolboy to voice my suspicions, Bonepenny and Stanley should never have gotten away with it, and Mr. Twining would not have been driven to take his own life. You see, Flavia, silence is sometimes the most costly of commodities. After a very long time and a great deal of thought, I decided, against everything I believe in, to give in to his blackmail. I would sell my collections, everything I owned, to buy his silence, and I must tell you, Flavia, that I am more ashamed of that decision than anything I have ever done in my life. Anything. I wish I had known the right thing to say, but for once my tongue failed me, and I sat there like a mop, not able even to look my father in the face. Sometime in the small hours, it must have been 4 o'clock, perhaps, since it was already becoming light outside, I turned out the lamp with the full intention of walking into the village, rousing Bonepenny from his room at the inn and agreeing to his demands. But something stopped me. I can't explain it, but it's true. I stepped out onto the terrace, but rather than going round to the front of the house to the drive, as I had determined to do, I found myself being drawn like a magnet to the coach house.
So, I thought, it wasn't Father who had gone out through the kitchen door. He had walked from the terrace outside his study, along the outside of the garden wall to the coach house. He had not set foot in the garden. He had not walked past the dying Horace Bonepenny.
I needed to think, Father went on, but I couldn't seem to bring my mind into proper focus.
And you got into Harriet's Rose, I blurted. Sometimes I could shoot myself.
Father stared at me with the sad kind of look the worm must give the early bird the instant before its beak snaps shut.
Yes, he said softly.
I was tired.
The last thing I remember thinking was that once Boney and Bob Stanley found I was a bankrupt, they'd give up the game for someone more promising. Not that I would ever wish this predicament on another. And then I must have fallen asleep. I don't know. It doesn't really matter. I was still there when the police found me.
A bankrupt? I said, astonished. I couldn't help myself. But, Father, you have Buckshaw.
Father looked at me, his eyes moist, eyes that I had never before seen looking out of his face.
Buckshaw belonged to Harriet, you see, and when she died intestate. She didn't leave a will. The death duties, well, the death duties shall most likely consume us.
But Buckshaw is yours, I said. It's been in the family for centuries.
No, Father said sadly. It's not mine. Not mine at all. You see, Harriet was a Deleuze before I married her. She was my third cousin. Buckshaw was hers. I have nothing left to invest in the place, not a sou. I am, as I have said, a virtual bankrupt.
There was a metallic tapping at the door, and Inspector Hewitt stepped into the room.
"I'm sorry, Colonel Deleuze," he said. "The Chief Constable, as you are undoubtedly aware, is most particular that the very shadow of the law be observed. I've allowed you as much time as I can, and still escape with my skin."
Father nodded sadly.
"Come along, Flavia," the inspector said to me. "I'll take you home."
"I can't go home yet," I said. "Someone's pinched my bicycle. I'd like to file a complaint."
"Your bicycle is in the back seat of my car."
"You found it already?" I asked.
"Hallelujah! Gladys was safe and sound." "It was never missing," he said. "I saw you park it out front and had Constable Glossop put it away for safekeeping."
"So that I couldn't escape?"
Father lifted an eyebrow at this impertinence, but said nothing. "In part, yes," Inspector Hewitt said, "but largely because it's still raining buckets outside and it's a long old pedal uphill to Buckshaw."
I gave Father a silent hug to which, although he remained rigid as an oak, he did not seem to object.
"Try to be a good girl, Flavia," he said.
"Try to be a good girl? Was that all he could think of?"
It was evident that our submarine had surfaced, its occupants hauled up from the vasty deeps and all the magic left below.
"I'll do my best," I said, turning away. "I'll do my very best."
"You mustn't be too hard on your father, you know," Inspector Hewitt said as he slowed to negotiate the turn at the fingerpost which pointed to Bishop's Lacey. I glanced at him, his face lit from below by the soft glow of the Vauxhall's instrument panel. The windscreen wipers, like black scythes, swashed back and forth across the glass in the strange light of the storm.
"Do you honestly believe he murdered Horace Bonepenny?" I asked.
His reply was ages in coming, and when it did, it was burdened with a heavy sadness.
"Who else was there, Flavia?" he said.
"Me," I said, "for instance." Inspector Hewitt flicked on the defroster to evaporate the condensation our words were forming on the windscreen. "You don't expect me to believe that story about the struggle and the dicky heart, do you? Because I don't. That isn't what killed Horace Bonepenny."
"It was the pie, then," I blurted out with sudden inspiration. "He was poisoned by the pie."
"Did you poison the pie?" he asked, almost grinning.
"No," I admitted, "but I wish I had."
"It was quite an ordinary pie," the inspector said. "I've already had the analyst's report."
"Quite an ordinary pie?"
This was the highest praise Mrs. Mullet's confections were ever likely to receive.
"As you've deduced," he went on, "Bonepenny did indeed indulge in a slice of pie several hours before his death. But how could you know that?"
"Well, who but a stranger would eat the stuff?"
I asked, with just enough of a scoff in my voice to mask the sudden realization that I had made a mistake. Bonepenny hadn't been poisoned by Mrs. Mullet's pie after all. It was childish to have pretended that he had.
"I'm sorry I said that," I told him. "It just popped out. You must think me a complete bloody fool."
Inspector Hewitt didn't reply for far too long. At last he said,
"Unless some sweetness at the bottom lie, who cares for all the crinkling of the pie?"
My grandmother used to say that, he added.
What does it mean? I asked.
It means, well, here we are at Buckshaw. They're probably worried about you.
Oh, said Ophelia in her careless voice. Have you been gone? We hadn't noticed, had we, Daff?
Daffy was showing the prominent equine whites of her eyes. She was definitely spooked, but trying not to let on.
No, she muttered, and plunged back into Bleak House.
Daffy was, if nothing else, a rapid reader. Had they asked, I should have told them gladly about my visit with Father, but they did not. If there was to be any grieving for his predicament, I was not to be a part of it. That much was clear. Feely and Daffy and I were like three grubs in three distinct cocoons, and sometimes I wondered why. Charles Darwin had once pointed out that the fiercest competition for survival came from one's own tribe, and as the fifth of six children, and with three older sisters, he was obviously in a position to know what he was talking about. To me it seemed a matter of elementary chemistry. I knew that a substance tends to be dissolved by solvents that are chemically similar to it. There was no rational explanation for this. It was simply the way of nature. It had been a long day, and my eyelids felt as if they'd been used for oyster rakes. I think I'll go to bed, I said. Good night, Feely. Good night, Daffy. My attempt at sociability was greeted with silence and a grunt. As I was making my way up the stairs, Dogger materialized suddenly above me on the landing with a candle holder that might have been snapped up at an estate sale at Mandalay.
"Colonel Deluce," he whispered.
"He is well, Dogger," I said. Dogger nodded a troubled nod, and we each of us trudged off to our respective quarters. Chapter 18 Grayminster School lay dozing in the sun, as if it were dreaming of past glories. The place was precisely as I had imagined it. Magnificent old stone buildings, tidy green lawns running down to the lazy river, and vast empty playing fields that seemed to give off silent echoes of cricket matches whose players were long dead. I leaned Gladys against a tree in the side lane by which I had entered the grounds. Behind a hedgerow, a tractor stood ticking idly, its driver nowhere in sight. The voices of choir boys came floating across the lawns from the chapel. In spite of the bright morning sunshine, they were singing, "Softly now the light of day fades upon my sight away." I stood listening for a moment until suddenly they broke off. Then, after a pause, the organ started up again, peevishly, and the singers went back to the beginning. As I walked slowly across the grass of what I'm sure Father would have called the quad, the tall, blank windows of the school stared down at me coldly, and I had the sudden queer feeling an insect must have when it's placed under a microscope, the feeling of an invisible lens hovering and something strange, perhaps, about the light. Except for a single schoolboy dashing along and two black-gowned masters walking and talking with their heads together, the broad lawns and winding walkways of Grayminster were empty beneath a sky of deepest blue. The whole place seemed slightly unreal, like a grossly enlarged Agfa colour print, something you might see in one of those books with a name such as Picturesque Britain. That limestone pile on the east side of the quad, the one with the clock tower, must be Anson House, I thought, Father's old digs. As I approached it, I raised my hand to shield my eyes against the glare of the sky. It was from somewhere up there, among the battlements and tiles, that Mr. Twining had plummeted to his death on the cobbles below, those ancient cobbles which now lay no more than 100 feet from where I was standing. I strolled across the grass to have a look. Disappointingly, there were no bloodstains. Of course there wouldn't be, not after all these years. Those would have been washed away as soon as was decently possible. Quite likely, even before Mr. Twining's broken body had been laid to whatever passed for rest. Other than of their constant wearing down by 200 years of privileged feet, these cobbles told no tales. Tucked tightly in along the stone walls of Anson House, the walk was scarcely 6 feet wide. I threw back my head and gazed straight up at the tower.
Viewed from this angle, it rose dizzily in a sheer wall of stone that ended far, far above me in a filigree of airy ornamental stonework where fat white clouds, drifting lazily past the parapets, created the peculiar sensation that the whole structure was leaning, falling, toppling towards me. The illusion made my stomach go all queasy and I had to look away. Worn stone steps led enticingly from the cobbled walk through an arched entrance to a double door. To my left was the porter's lodge, its occupant huddled over a telephone. He did not even look up as I slipped inside. A cool, dim corridor stretched away in front of me, to infinity it seemed, and I set out along it, lifting my feet carefully to keep from making scuffing noises on the slate floor. On either side, a long gallery of smiling faces, some of them schoolboys and some masters, receded into the darkness, each one a grey Minsterian who had given his life for his country, and each in his own black lacquered frame, that others might live, it said on a gilded scroll. At the end of the corridor, set apart from the others, were photographs of three boys, their names engraved in red on little brass rectangles. Under each name were the words, "Missing in action." Missing in action? Why wasn't Father's photo hanging there, I wondered. Father was generally as absent as these young men whose bones were somewhere in France. I felt a little guilty at the thought, but it was true. I think it was at that moment, there in the shadowy hall at Greyminster, that I began to realize the full extent of Father's distant nature. Yesterday, I had been all too ready to throw my arms around him and hug him to jelly, but now I understood that yesterday's cozy prison scene had not been a dialogue, but a troubled monologue. It had not been me, but Harriet to whom he was speaking. And, as with the dying Horace Bonepenny, I had been no more than an unwitting confessor. Now, just being here at Greyminster, where Father's troubles had begun, it seemed all the more cold and remote and inhospitable a place. In the gloom beyond the photos, a staircase led up to the first floor, and I climbed up it to a hallway which, like the one I had left below, also ran the length of the building. Although the doors on either side were closed, each one was fitted with a small pane of glass, which allowed me a peek into the room. There were classrooms and all alike. At the end of the corridor, a large corner room promised something more. A sign on its door read "Chemistry Lab." I tried the door and it opened at once. The curse was broken. I don't know what I was expecting, but I wasn't expecting this. Stained wooden tables, boring flasks, cloudy retorts, chipped test tubes, inferior Bunsen burners, and a coloured wall chart of the elements containing a laughable printing error in which the positions of arsenic and selenium were interchanged. I spotted this at once and, with a nub of blue chalk from the ledge beneath the blackboard, took the liberty of correcting the mistake by drawing in a two-headed arrow. "Wrong," I wrote beneath it and underlined the word twice. This so-called lab was nothing compared with my own at Buckshaw, and at the thought, my chest swelled with pride. I wanted nothing more than to bolt for home at once, just to be there, to touch my own gleaming glassware, to concoct the perfect poison just for the thrill of it. But that pleasure would have to wait. There was work to be done. Back outside in the corridor, I retraced my steps to the center of the building. If I had guessed accurately, I should now be directly under the tower, and the entrance to it could not be far away. A small door in the panelling, which I had taken at first to be a broom closet, swung open to reveal a steep stone staircase. My heart skipped a beat. And then I saw the sign. A few steps up from the bottom, a length of chain was draped across the steps, with a hand-printed card, "Tower off limits, strictly enforced." I was up them like a shot. It was like being inside a nautilus shell. The stairs twisted round and round, winding their narrow way upwards in echoing sameness. There was no possible way of seeing what lay ahead or, for that matter, what lay behind. Only the few steps immediately above and below me were visible. For a while I counted them in a whisper as I climbed, but after a time I found that I needed my breath to fuel my legs. It was a steep ascent, and I was getting a stitch in my side.
I stopped for a moment to rest. What little light there was appeared to be coming from tiny slit windows, one positioned at each complete turn of the staircase. On that side of the tower, I guessed, lay the quad. Still short of breath, I resumed my ascent. Then suddenly an unexpected